Case number 15-5049, Victor Charles Forestar Jr. Appellant v. Garden City Group, Inc. et al. Mr. Kozak for the amicus curiae, Ms. Lyons for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, my name is Jonathan Kozak, as amicus curiae on behalf of appellant Victor Forestar. Your Honors, the Court has requested amicus to address two issues that at their very foundation ask whether this Court should turn its back on its long history of interpreting literally the three strikes provision of the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act. The PLRA identifies three grounds upon which an action may be dismissed in its entirety and constitute a strike: frivolousness, maliciousness, and failure to state a claim. The question here is whether the Court should read into the statute two additional grounds, what I'll refer to as a declination, in which a court declines to exercise supplemental jurisdiction or state law claim, and what I'll refer to as an express strike, in which a court expressly states that a case it is dismissing constitutes a strike under the PLRA. Under this Court's precedent in Thompson versus DEA and Butler versus DOJ, which are dispositive in this case, the Court should decline to read those grounds into the statute. These issues are at play in this case because Appellant Forestar petitioned to proceed in forma pauperis and was denied that privilege by the District Court, who concluded that Forestar had already accumulated three strikes. The three cases it identified are what I'll shorthand as Murlach, Zemian, and Ness. In two of the three cases where it incorrectly identified as strikes, those were Zemian and Ness. In neither Zemian nor Ness were all of the claims dismissed on one of or more of the enumerated grounds under the three strikes provision.
Can I ask a road mapping question to get me started here, which is, let's suppose we agree with you on your express strike argument, right?
Okay. Labeling.
I'm sorry?
Your proposition that the court's labeling
yes.
what it's doing as an express strike should
if,
not change.
If we agreed with you on that, the Zemian one falls just under Thompson itself.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I think. And therefore, we wouldn't necessarily have to address your first, what you're calling, declination argument, because there would only be two strikes then. Is that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Just making sure I understand. Okay. Keep going.
So, as you correctly identified, in Zemian, the federal claims were dismissed for a lack of subject matter jurisdiction, a non-enumerated ground, which the court already found in Thompson. And the state law claim was dismissed without prejudice when the court declined to exercise supplemental jurisdiction, in part because the state law claim involved a highly novel application of state law. So based on Zemian alone, the lower court's decision should be reversed. And the government has conceded that Zemian was incorrectly identified as a strike on the basis of the dismissal of the federal claim.
Right, but they argue you should take the express strike as it stands, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Ness was also incorrectly decided because in Ness the federal claims were dismissed for failure to state a claim, but the state law claims were dismissed for lack of because the court declined to exercise subject matter jurisdiction, but also because the state law involved highly novel applications of state law, and that's important here because the PLRA was meant to stem the tide of egregiously meritless cases, and a state law claim that's a highly novel application of state law.
Is it important to your argument that the reason behind the declination was complex issues under state law? I mean, I'm grasping for why under the Thompson framework that should make any difference.
Your Honor, I would say that it's not critical that
It's icing on a cake already frosted.
Yes. Right? Thank you, Your Honor. Yes.
That's right.
As long as our basic point is that a declination is not one of the three enumerated grounds.
To the extent that you're using it to suggest that the state law claim was probably strong, it's one possibility. Another possibility is the state law claim was so far out that the poor judge doesn't want to plow through the way in which you establish that it's far out and is therefore a loser. So, I'm just thinking that to make that a significant part of a ruling would be troublesome.
I understand that, Your Honor. I think the point is, though, that what the court didn't do was say that the state law claim was frivolous or failed to state a claim, and that would have been an enumerated ground.
Right.
So they specifically chose a different ground, which is a non-enumerated ground.
Right. I think you're saying it doesn't come within the literal terms of the statute, and because sometimes the state law claims may be novel or complex, it doesn't even come within the spirit, at least in those cases.
That's correct.
But we don't have to get to the spirit if we agree with you on the literal.
That's correct. The only other question is whether this express strike should be given any legal effect. And again, it's the looking at the statute. The word strike isn't even in Section 1915G, it simply is superfluous. If the lower court identifies the three enumerated grounds, there's no need for it to go on to say this constitutes a strike by itself.
We're interested in the apparent reasoning of the lower court, period, is your argument.
Correct. And then that's what the court suggested or indicated in Thompson, is that it's incumbent upon the lower court to establish the three enumerated grounds, or that it's dismissing on one of the three enumerated grounds, in order to make it clear and ease the burden on the following court. And so allowing an express strike to sort of stand in place would be problematic, because you wouldn't know which of the three grounds. It would become a difficult issue to address on appeal.
It doesn't help the classification issue, as far as I can make out.
Right.
This isn't critical to your argument, but suppose a district court dismisses a claim for failure to a case for failure to state a claim upon which relief may be granted, and it's clear that the original district court, completely botched that, and it was actually a jurisdictional dismissal. Can we look behind that or not?
No, Your Honor. Under Thompson, you can't.
Okay.
That's not an issue here.
Right. Now, I understand it's not an issue here. I'm just making sure your reading of Thompson's the same as my reading, which is you can look behind the label express strike, your shorthand, but you can't look behind the substantive basis on which the district court acted, even if that was erroneous.
Right. I mean, if the district court said this is a failure to state a claim, but it was actually lack of subject matter jurisdiction, you're sort of out of luck under Thompson. But if the district court says this is a strike, but it's clear that they were wrong because they relied on a non-enumerated ground, that can be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what the Ninth Circuit did in Eliason, and we submitted a Rule 28J letter on that issue. And the court reversed.
Now, suppose that, I don't think this argument's still in the case, but suppose another court of appeals, as the Third Circuit did here, has looked at this and said, this person already has three strikes.
In this particular case.
I'll give you time, by the way. Don't worry about that light.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ryan. Yeah. In this particular case, the Third Circuit relied on the same three cases. And I would say that in that particular case, the court has the ability to sort of reevaluate the prisoner's history and determine whether that was actually an accurate ruling.
I mean, I guess that's an argument that applies in an awful lot of issue preclusion cases, right? In any event, built into issue preclusion is the idea that you're not required. In fact, it's an almost optional doctrine. You're not required to follow decisions that are transparently wrong. I think, in a sense, you're fitting it into that box.
I'll be happy to label it. One of the three factors in the preclusive effect concept is if it were working on fairness, it's not to be given preclusive effect. And I think here it's obvious to most everybody that Zemian is not to be considered a strike. And so in Eckroth, the Third Circuit case, that makes that ruling quite problematic.
It's even easier here, right? Because you have the Ninth Circuit saying he's not, and the Third Circuit saying he is. And so if you have two which one would we give collateral estoppel effect to?
Right.
You're going to pick the Ninth Circuit. We're going to pick the Third Circuit.
But your point is, even if we only had one, it doesn't matter in either direction.
That's correct.
But it certainly works in unfairness if there's another court of appeals that went the other way.
I think that in this particular case, it appears that these three cases, Murlock, Ness, and Zemian, have been sort of the underlying basis and has sort of been passed along among a number of different courts. And I think finally the Ninth Circuit said, no, this is not right. And I think the district court here the D.C. Circuit here, based on its own precedent, should find the same.
What about the argument that we say declination of supplemental jurisdiction does not make a decision a strike? If that's part of what happens in the case, the decision won't be a strike, even if the rest of what the district court did was a 12b-6 dismissal. And so now what every prisoner is going to do is lob in a couple state law claims. What's your answer to that concern?
My answer to that is that's what I like to call a parade of horribles question, open up the floodgates question, which this court addressed in Butler, which involved a failure to prosecute. And that was a problem that was apparently rampant. And this court said, okay, we're looking at the statute. The statute says that provides three enumerated grounds. A failure to prosecute is not one of those grounds. And it's up to the Congress to address that problem if it wishes. And the Supreme Court did the same thing in Nitschke versus Williams when failure to state a claim wasn't one of the three enumerated grounds and was also, the prison officials were also, concerned about this issue. And again, the Supreme Court said if Congress wants to deal with that, Congress can, and Congress did. And so here, in this case, if
your answer is Congress should fix it if that comes to pass.
That's my answer.
Would it also be the case that if this didn't run, the idea that this was an end run in the requirements of 1915, and we shoved it into the hitherto threefold category to make it a fourfold category, prisoners presumably come up with all kinds of similarly effective devices for protecting themselves, right? I mean, it's hard for me to see that something uniquely advantageous from a prisoner's point of view about hope raising a state law claim that might trigger this particular type of disposition.
Yeah, I agree, Your Honor. I think there's nothing unique about a declination being a particularly effective way of gaming the system that was any way different than a failure to prosecute, where this court simply said is not a reason to read a non-enumerated ground into the statute.
Okay. Thank you. We'll hear from you on rebuttal. We'll hear from the government now. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Certainly, I'd just like to pick up where you left off. Adding state law claims as a way around the three strikes rule in the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act won't be a way to game the system until a court recognizes it as such. So that's what's at stake here today.
I'm assuming it will become a way to game the system, but I'm also assuming I have no proper role in preventing that.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. The statute obviously doesn't speak directly to the question. The the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act does not say what a court should do when there are state law claims.
Well, the statute, though, identifies the bases on which something will count as a strike.
Correct.
And that's an exclusive list, as I read this statute. And when it's dismissed on some other ground or declined to exercise some part of the jurisdiction over some part of the case, that doesn't fall within one of these three.
Right. Well, but let's maybe it would be good to talk about the Zemion case in particular here. Because Zemion is an interesting thing. That's something for everyone, I like to say.
Well, that doesn't even qualify under Thompson, right?
I disagree, and right. Let me tell you why.
Okay.
In Zemion, it was a legal malpractice case against a private attorney seeking damages. The federal claims were dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. The state claims were dismissed without prejudice. So there's no question the entire action is dismissed, and there's no declination per se of supplemental jurisdiction. That idea comes out of what the report and recommendation suggested. And, interestingly, the report and recommendation was accepted by the court. But the court also said plaintiff's claims are so frivolous that no reasonable person could suppose that an appeal would have merit. So that wasn't restricted to the federal claims. That label, that frivolous label, sticks onto the state law claims as well. So Zemion is dismissed.
How do we know that? Because what he's saying is you couldn't take an appeal, and you could easily say that appealing the merits of the federal claims, that would be frivolous. And appealing a decision not to exercise supplemental jurisdiction when something is kicked out at the threshold like this would also be frivolous. But that doesn't mean that the underlying claims themselves are frivolous.
Respectfully, I disagree, Your Honor. The beginning of the sentence says the plaintiff's claims are so frivolous without reference to whether he's talking about the state or the federal claims. And I think it means both. It's certainly a reasonable interpretation.
The state law claims are dismissed without prejudice. So I'm trying to figure out, on the prior page, that's the district court,
right,
not the magistrate judge. So if the district court is not exercising jurisdiction over those claims, on what legal basis?
Right. It's effectively. I agree that it's effectively declining to exercise supplemental jurisdiction.
Effectively,
that's not literally
what he says he's doing.
Pardon me?
You can't say on one page that those things are dismissed without prejudice and then say, I'm making a legal ruling that they're frivolous. I don't understand how you can have those two things under your reading. I had read the frivolousness as to the appeal of a declination.
It's one possible reading, but I think it informs what the court has said in Thompson was, we're going to look to what happens, what really happened. We're not going to look behind it. We're going to look to what happened. And in Zemion, the entire case is dismissed. So it is arguably.
Would you agree that to evaluate the merits of the state law claims, the court would have to first decide to exercise jurisdiction over them, or can a district court say, I'm not exercising jurisdiction?
That really
and by the way, they're frivolous.
Yeah, that gets really to the heart of our argument, which is that exactly that pivot point. If the court declines supplemental jurisdiction, as it is, generally speaking, required to by Section 1367 when it's dismissing all of the federal claims, and that's a statute that it has to comply with simultaneously with the PLRA, right? So at that point, any commentary that the district court makes on the claims themselves, it really shouldn't do it at all. And if it does it, it's purely advisory. It has no legal effect one way or the other.
Right.
And to force the district courts to interpret the PLRA this way, to require the district courts to tread into that water for purposes of clarifying whether the action is frivolous or it's a strike, consumes the very resources that the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act was designed to avoid having courts do. It's designed to be a more efficient way of looking at things. So when a court takes the federal claims and dismisses them for reasons that qualify under the PLRA, the supplemental jurisdiction claims need to be sort of disregarded. They don't affect the nature of the dismissal. The entire case is dismissed. And that's what the statute says. The statute doesn't parse it by claims. It says the action. And the action remains dismissed under the PLRA when this
and
happens.
And your view is when part of the claims that are dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, that counts as I'm still not understanding your next part here. Since we agree that anything they said about frivolousness is an advisory opinion because they aren't exercising jurisdiction.
Right.
And if they say federal claims are out for failure to state a claim, state claims are out because I'm not exercising jurisdiction, so the action is dismissed.
Right.
How does that help you? Because the PLRA says we have to look at the basis for dismissal? Not just whether something was dismissed, but what is the legal basis for dismissal?
But the focus of the PLRA is properly on the federal claims, because that's what Congress was directed at.
Well, isn't that quite a modification of Thompson?
No, Your Honor. I think that the thing to understand about what Thompson said about when there are individual claims that aren't dismissed for reasons that qualify under the PLRA, it was talking about a situation. The example the court gave was when one claim is dismissed under Rule 12b-6 and one claim succeeds on the merits. That's a very different situation than what you have with a declination of supplemental jurisdiction on claims.
Can I make sure I understand one thing? If one claim is dismissed for lack of jurisdiction and one claim is dismissed for failure to state a claim, your answer is?
If we are not in the District of Columbia, it can be a strike. If the court is in the District of Columbia, of course, under Thompson, it cannot be.
Okay. Just making sure I understand that.
And that gets to another sort of point that's running through this, which maybe jumps to the preclusiveness side, but the rules are different in different jurisdictions. Other jurisdictions have recognized lack of jurisdiction as a potentially qualifying strike. That doesn't hold here, and until the Supreme Court settles that, there's no other way to get around that. But Thompson speaks in terms, correctly identifies the statute as speaking in terms of dismissal of actions and not claims. Mm-hmm. So this is why it has to be this way. Otherwise, it will be trivial for, as Judge Millett at least posited, for prisoners to add state law claims purely as a way to immunize themselves from getting strikes under the PLRA.
So can I go back to parsing the Zemian order?
Sure.
And is your reading of that the case was dismissed on frivolousness grounds?
My reading of the case is that it's mixed. It is dismissed. The federal claims were dismissed clearly for lack of jurisdiction. The state claims are dismissed without prejudice, which is, I think, probably better read, as Judge Millett suggests, as declining to exercise supplemental jurisdiction
Correct.
Over them in the context of all of the report and recommendation and the adoption by the district court. Mm-hmm. I note that it's the same district judge who dismissed Ness. It's mm-hmm. the same judge. 2 years earlier, he dismissed Ness and there expressly declined to exercise supplemental jurisdiction over state law claims.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually gets to one of the other points of sort of administering the PLRA. This court in Thompson suggested that it was a relatively easy step for judges to make it clear whether they were deeming claims frivolous, malicious, or so failing to state a claim that they should be counted as a strike. Experience 10 years on perhaps teaches that while it may be a relatively easy step, it's not always taken. We've got some courts in the country that are apparently being told not to take it at all. So this question, take the step of enumerating, labeling something as a strike or saying it's being dismissed.
Those are separate things, right?
Dismissal and labeling as a strike.
Normally a court does say what it is doing. That's somewhat different from labeling it with respect to possible downstream consequences.
Right. So in this case, we're dealing with a court that dismissed the cases and labeled them as strikes. That's what this case is about. And express strikes in that situation, as Thompson recognized, to the advantage of a bright line that avoids the name to relitigate those underlying cases is considerable. And Thompson recognized that and said we shouldn't relitigate these cases if they're dismissed.
Now, that was I read Thompson as saying you can't relitigate the erroneous dismissal, the erroneous 12b-6 dismissal.
The erroneous, what do you mean by that?
Suppose the district court says, I am dismissing this case for failure to state a claim under Rule 12b-6. That's all the district court says.
Right.
And if we looked at that, we'd say that was crazy. It was actually a dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. I read Thompson to say we can't second guess the district court judge's grounds for dismissal there. However, if the district court says, I dismiss for failure to state a claim for lack of jurisdiction, and I'm labeling that a strike, I don't read Thompson to say we can't second-guess the labeling as a strike. Do you understand the distinction?
I understand the distinction you're drawing. And then the third thing I would point out to you is that Thompson also suggests that the Court of Appeals might have a pass on that, because it also says where a Court of Appeals affirms a case, affirms a decision, but calls it frivolous, they appeal frivolous, it can't. The court could look behind that and say it should have been a dismissal pursuant to its duty under 1915E2B, I believe. So there's
But you didn't read Zemian as a dismissal on frivolousness grounds, did you?
No.
Okay.
No, it's a declination of
dismissal for lack of jurisdiction, and the state law claims are
right. Right. The state law claims are dismissed without prejudice. It happens to note.
Okay.
The reason's not clear.
It's amazing how complicated this has become, but
and it's supposed to be such a simple system,
right? It's supposed to be simple.
It's supposed to be easy.
Are you all still making the broader collateral estoppel argument, or by that I mean because the third
circuit because it's called a strike, it should be a strike?
No, I know you're making that argument.
Right.
That say another court of appeals, put aside the third and ninth circuits here.
Right.
Say another court of appeals has looked at this for this person and said he or she has three strikes. Are you making a collateral estoppel kind of issue preclusion argument?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Is this a government-wide position? I'm curious whether Maine Justice has.
I have not coordinated this position with Maine Justice, Your Honor. And that's an appropriate thing for me to note.
Okay.
What I would say is like legions of math teachers through the years, when a court says somebody has three strikes, it benefits all of us if they'll show their work and at least then identify what strikes are in play.
Right.
And I think,
so you didn't want to defend that here?
I do not want to defend that here.
Okay.
That's not the grounds on which the district court ruled.
Yeah.
And I don't feel compelled to defend it here because of that.
It was lurking in some of the earlier papers in this case.
Yeah, there are lots of things lurking in the papers.
Yes. Okay.
You know,
but then they disappeared in your red brief, I noticed.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is Mr. Forstar still incarcerated? I know he was, I guess, something he was picked back up in January. Is there any sense, for purposes of evaluating how important these strikes are going forward, how many strikes he has going forward, is he still in prison or is there?
The most current information I had, which I tried to glean from the Bureau of Prisons inmate locator system last night, is that he was not represented in that system as in custody, but he hasn't been, well, I know he has been in custody, pursuant to having been rearrested for failure to register as a sex offender. So I can't speak with certainty to that issue, but I know it doesn't make a difference to the resolution of this case unless the court were to decide it didn't matter. But since there seem to be ongoing issues, I think it does matter whether he has three strikes or not.
I'm sorry, that is ongoing.
To Mr. Forstar.
He's conceding liberty for the rest of his life.
Then he remains free, of course, to file as a non-incarcerated person, and nothing about his prior litigation history would impact his.
Right.
That's true. But I can't. If it's important to the court, I will find out and file a letter.
Well, could he go back in this case and say, well, now I'm entitled to IFP free of the PLRA?
He might be able to do that if he refiled the case, but this case having been filed while he was been a prisoner, our position would be the Prisoner Litigation Act Reform Act applies. If I could briefly turn, I know my red light is on, but if I could briefly turn to this, the preclusiveness of the strikes, the court has made it fairly clear that it disagrees with my position, but it makes it a hard system if courts go to the trouble, I mean, if it isn't much trouble and the courts go to it, to then lightly disregard what another court says in another jurisdiction.
Well,
about
to give you half a loaf, it's not going to be irrelevant when the district court says that about its own decision. It'll be useful evidence for a court down the road, but it won't be dispositive. In other words, if we reject your position on the preclusiveness of the strike label,
right,
that's not going to make the strike labeling exercise completely worthless.
Okay. Well, I have two quick points then on that. One is that this case is not here on de novo review of these strikes right now. It is here on the district court's decision, and we at least raised in our brief the possibility that not all of these cases are subject to the same exact standard of review. Now, I will readily, we cited the Barber versus Browner case, which talked about mixed standards of review or mixed case law and fact review. And this is an area, one of the examples cited in Barber for the need for de novo review would be where the law needs to be developed. And I can't stand here and say that the law here is so clear, there's not that. So what all I'm suggesting is there's no reflexive need here to do de novo review. You may do that here for legitimate reasons, but as a general matter, this case is here on the district court's decision, dismissal, not on this court's motion for IFP.
Okay.
So that's a distinction.
Last point?
Which I forgot in making that one too long.
Okay.
Hold on.
You're talking about the collateral estoppel, if that helps you.
Oh, collateral estoppel. Collateral estoppel? Oh, yeah, I was talking about that? Okay. It doesn't apply here. The Prisoner Litigation Reform Act is a statute that has to be complied with. The judicially created doctrine of collateral estoppel doesn't really have an application in this setting. When a court says it's a strike, the federal judiciary, here's my point, federal judiciary has a means for that to be resolved. That would be a direct appeal to the appellate court to get the strike overturned, or perhaps a Rule 60B6, probably, motion back to the deciding judge to remove the strike.
That's, to just flood new litigation into challenging the late strike label alone, I don't know.
That seems a very convincing argument why it should make little or no difference, the imposition of the label.
The imposition of the label should make some difference because it, as Thompson recognizes, it's little enough of an extra thing once a court has gone as far as it has evaluating the claim.
I was just talking about saying, make clear the basis of your action.
Yeah.
That's different.
All I can say in closing, Your Honor, is that I think it should have, and perhaps that's ultimately your point, Judge Kavanaugh. It's not that it has no value. It's just that it's not necessarily going to be dispositive in every situation.
Okay. Thank you very much for your argument, and we'll give you 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Unless you have any further questions, I'm prepared to.
Okay, that's a wise choice. You were appointed, Mr. Shelley and Mr. Kosak, you were appointed by the court, and the court thanks you very much for your excellent assistance in this case.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.